Welcome back to Humans of Speedway. I'm Ian Brannan, and in this episode, I'm joined by yet another world champion, but this one, as we'll discover, has never ridden a Speedway bike.
If you've not seen me on the telly, I am a bit of a lump, really, so I've got to be honest with you, I have the figure for a dart player, but not for a Speedway rider.
Scott Mitchell is a lifelong Speedway fan and a huge supporter of the Poole Pirates, and his day job is split between being a farmer and a professional darts player, where in 2015, he scaled the heights of the sport to become the BDO World Darts Champion.
Double top to be crowned World Champion. Misses with the first.
Game. Chop.
Hits with the second.
And the 2015 Lakeside World Darts Champion is Scott Mitchell.
Every dog has his day. And for Scotty Dog Mitchell, that day is today.
We'll find out more about his rise to the top of darts despite only finding his way into the sport in his late 30s, and how his success at the Oki has led to a secret career working alongside some of TV and film's household names. Plus, he'll be putting together his Speedway Paradise, building his own dream meeting before the end too. So it gives me great pleasure to welcome our next Human of Speedway, Scott Mitchell.
Hi, how are you doing, Ian?
I'm very good, thanks. And it's great to have you joining us on this episode of Humans of Speedway. And of course, we're here to talk about Speedway. But first of all, let's talk darts, because 2020 has thrown all sorts of chaos generally in sports direction. Darts has sort of kind of found a way. Obviously, very, very different times. How's it been for you so far?
Yeah. It's been a strange year, obviously, for the darts, really. We haven't been able to play, and the bits that we have done have been kind of in bubbles in varying hotels or arenas that have hotels attached to them when we have been allowed to play. So we've not been as bad as some other sports, which are, you know, totally sort of desecrated 2020, as Speedway has been in the UK. And, I've been lucky enough to play a bit of online darts as well. There was a day back in April where I think we were the only live sport going on in the world. That was online. I was playing at home in my spare room. So, it's been a strange year for everybody, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. But how did that work then, playing at home? Was it like a video camera on your board and there was sort of adding up the score that way? I mean,
darts is a very simple sport, but it can get very technical when it needs to be. So we have a scoring system called Darts Connect that works all around the world. So we could log into Darts Connect and use an iPad to put the scores and everything in as we played. We were actually just saying the score after we'd thrown. So if you hit 140, hit 140, called 140 as if I was the MC, and then at HQ they put the score in and it comes up on my pad what I've scored and what I've got left. It was very clever, and we obviously had cameras as close to the board as we can get them, one facing the player and one facing the board, so that, you know, there was no cheating going on.
Did you announce your score in the way that the MC usually does, like 140?
Yes, you did end up doing it. It was 140, and then you take your darts out, and it was rather weird. And then there's other players that are very so it would depend on who you were actually playing. There'd be another player that would just hit 140, go 140, you know, with about as much enthusiasm as anything. So sometimes you got drawn into it. I'd go 180.
And
it was fun. It was really different for all of us, and it was fun. So we were able to still get ourselves out there to a lot of people that were still watching it during lockdown, because obviously they were at home all day. So the viewing figures were really good, and everybody was happy.
Well, they will be good, because I remember that sort of period where there was there was no sport on in the world one weekend, and everybody's like, "What do we do now?" So I think it was the turn of the minority sport, if you want to phrase it like that. So that, you know, football wasn't happening, and all the other major sports, if you want to call them that, weren't happening. You know, tennis wasn't on, for example, like Wimbledon would usually be on through the summer, and you know, it was the turn of those sports that were able to get underway that normally wouldn't have had the exposure that really benefited as well.
Yeah, I think that's been a bit of a problem. I mean, I know that the PDC obviously is run by Barry Hearn and Matt Porter, and they've managed to get sponsors to cover tournaments to be played behind closed doors so that they could still be put on Sky, and it's been a mammoth task for them to get any darts anywhere. So We are very lucky, we are very fortunate, and you know, some sports have been really harmed by it, and we're fortunate that, yes, we've been harmed by it at grassroots level, but at a top level we've still been able to play.
Now, obviously, we're talking there about darts, which is the sport that you play, but you are a fan of Speedway, which is why we're speaking to you on our podcast, Humans of Speedway. We haven't turned into Humans of Darts, although maybe we could do that another day. But you're a Poole Pirates fan, and you're a South Coast lad, born and bred.
Yeah, I'm from a little village called Bransgor, which is just between Christchurch and Ringwood, down on the Hampshire-Dorset border. So we're right on the edge of the Dew Forest. We're 2 miles away from the beach down at Christchurch, and 500... half a mile away from the New Forest, so and we've got a little piece of farm there, and I thought everybody had an area like that, but until I started traveling with the darts, I realized the world wasn't exactly the same as the little idyllic village that I live.
Yeah, growing up on a farm, I imagine a sort of different upbringing from the majority of people in the UK. I mean, I know there are a lot of farmers, but it's a different life, isn't it? It is a lifestyle, because it requires work, day in, day out to keep the thing running, and through the seasons, obviously the demands change, don't they?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, particularly with a tenant farmer, where we're tenant farmers, so we rent the land as well. You know, if you own the land and you haven't got to find the rent, it can be a little bit easier to make a profit. But for us small holders, it's very difficult. And you know, farmers said it's tough times, like we have with the COVID. I mean, the BSE and the foot and mouth back sort of 20, 30 years ago, sort of saw me having to leave the farmers as a young man of 25, 26. And, I thought my world had ended, because that's all I ever did. I jumped in a tractor at 8 years old and was driving it around the fields, and that's all I ever wanted to do. So to have the wool pulled out from under you like that, sort of like in your late 20s, and just to save the farm, really. You know, we had about 250 acres at that point. So the good thing about renting is you can give it back, or being a tenant, you can give it back and say, I can't afford to to have it. So that was the one plus side of being a tenant. So, you know, we saw hardship, we saw hard times, but dad had to let myself and my brother go, which is obviously one of the hardest things he would have ever had to do in his life. And we went off and found other things, and then the darts came along. So, everything, sort of one door closes, another door opens.
You're listening to Humans of Speedway. I'm Ian Brannan. I'm joined by 2015 BDO World Darts Champion Scott Mitchell. And we'll talk more about darts in just a bit, Scott. But let's turn our attention now to Speedway. And are you, like so many other people I've spoken to, the sort of person who was introduced to Speedway at an early age? Has it always been a constant for you, sort of going down to Wimborne Road to watch Poole, or were you a late discoverer of the sport?
Yes, very, very, very young. Apparently, I've been told by my mother that my first Speedway meeting at Poole, I went through the turnstiles at 2 weeks old in a carry cot. So we're talking mum and dad were into the Speedway in a big way at that time, which we're now talking the 70s, when they were sort of just in their early 20s when they had me. And of course, my dad and my dad's brother, they were into it big time. So Uncle Richard would come with us every week. My grandparents were the ones that started them going, sort of back in probably, I would say, the late 50s probably. Mm-hmm. Maybe even a bit earlier than that. And they used to go, you know, they told me stories about sort of riding or catching trains and riding bikes from sort of Hinton Admiral near Bransgor, and, getting off of bikes and riding to the stadium and then riding back and getting a train back. It's just amazing how they used to do it then. It wasn't as easy as getting in a car and just going, you know. So you can say it's in the blood, I think. There's three or four generations of the course. A small village like ours, everybody went. So, you know, if there was going to be a burglary in our village back in the 60s, it would be on a Wednesday night when everybody was at Poole. So, at Wimborne Road. So, there were four or five cars used to go from the village back then, which is, you know, half the village gone. So Speedway was a pretty big thing in my life back then. And I probably, in the early 70s, and as I was growing up, I probably wasn't into football till probably the late 70s when I was 7, 8, 9 years old. It was just Speedway, Speedway, Speedway.
Yeah, you tend to find that, and it's similar from my how I sort of got into Speedway as well. You know, it's the same as you said, like my grandparents, it's my grandma that went. She used to go to Edinburgh, again, sort of early 50s or around then, and then it's gone through the family, really. And hopefully I can get my daughter to go, but she doesn't. She's only four, and she doesn't really like the sound of loud bikes at the minute, which is the main obstacle. But we'll get there.
It's funny. I've taken my kids as well, and my daughter absolutely loves it. She's 26. She's always loved it. Whenever we get, because my first actual when I met my wife, I took her on a date to Paul Speedway. Our first time, we were about 17 or 18 or something. And and our first date, I took her to Paul Speedway, and she liked it. But as the kids were younger and the expense of it all, and you didn't have a lot of money, so both of us couldn't go. So I kept going because that was my sort of weekly thing, really. And Sharon stayed home with the kids, and then we went out as family nights. We did it as a family night, as a treat, sort of two or three times a year when we could afford to do it. And then my son really can take it or leave it. He's not bothered. He'll sit and watch it on the telly with me or whatever, but not worried about coming to Paul to watch it. But Katie comes every week and she doesn't miss it. So good daddy daughter time.
Yeah, it is a great family day out. I think that's what makes Speedway, isn't it? It's the whole occasion. But is it right that you, though, were you into your motorbikes in general, and you were sort of into motocross as a youngster?
Yeah. Well, we down south, we had this a couple of friends of mine used to ride schoolboy motocross, and I would go with them as sort of like 8 or 9 or 10 and watch them riding motocross. So I was into motocross as well. And one of them actually was Mark Seabright. He was a friend of mine at 10 years old and now spanners for Doily. So it's quite strange. And he had a grass track career. And Jeff Wiltshire was Southern Centre champion, a grass tracker, and 10 or 12 years older than me. And they used to live in one of our farmhouses. His father did. So there was just everything around me. And Pete Munday, God rest his soul, lived about a mile away from our farm, and he used to come down and test his bikes back in the 60s on my granddad's farm. You know, there was nowhere to test speedway bikes then, so he used to come down on a grass field and Pete used to test them there, you know. So I suppose I had no choice. That speedway was always going to be kind of the number one sport for me, and probably always will be.
But with your background in motocross, obviously an interest in bikes in general, did you never consider giving Speedway a bash at all? I mean, could you have been the 2015 World Speedway Champion instead of darts?
No, if you've not seen me on the telly, I am a bit of a lump, really. So I'll be honest with you, I have the figure for a dart player, but not for a Speedway rider, to be totally honest. So I rode motocross from probably 18 till about 24. And then when we had the children, I was blatting up a straight on, and there was Katie, my daughter, 3-4 months old, waving at daddy going up the straight flat out in fifth gear. And I thought, if I crash now, the wife's not earning, I'm the only one earning, we've got a house to the job, this is starting to take too many more risks than I need to be taking here. So that's and the fact that I'd sort of did some 500cc sort of amateur AMCA British Championship qualifiers and failed to qualify for the top 40 in the country. So I kind of knew that I wasn't good enough. I was daft enough. I just wasn't fast enough. So and I wasn't committed enough, probably. You know, I didn't want to go out running every night and all that sort of thing to make me as fit as a top guy. So, things happen for a reason. I just decided to knock it on the head. And I've been in every hospital in the south of England, you know, and you start going to hospital and they go, oh, hi, Scott, at the emergency ward, when you're going in again. it kind of, you know, and dad was at home going, what am I going to do with you? I've had a sort of like an ankle in cast and he's put me in the tractor and gave me and strapped my leg up because I had to have my leg elevated. So he strapped my leg up to the steering column in my tractor and I've gone off silaging for the day, and he's given me a bottle and said, oh, I said, I can't get out, go to the toilet. And he's given me a bottle and said, well, there you go. You'll be able to empty that out the window every couple of hours. And I thought, oh, thanks, dad. So it was getting to the point where I was getting injured and it was affecting my work as well. So, it was time. But at 24 years old, I matured myself to say I'm not doing it anymore.
Yeah, you paint a glamorous picture there. Speedway, though, is a high-risk sport, as we well know. I think maybe if that is the case, you maybe made the better decision. Darts, you definitely see less spectacular injuries in darts, even at worst.
Absolutely. And I mean, I'd love to have a go. That's my one regret. I've always wanted to have a go on a speedway bike. That's my one regret. But now I'm the ripe old age of 50. And it's probably not the right time to start doing things like that. And the wife has said she'd divorce me if I get on another bike. So the problem with it is the fact that obviously if I go and have a little blat and I can't even play cricket or anything, if I break a finger or whatever, then I can't throw a dart properly. So You know, any injury to me right hand side, or you know, my arm or anything would affect the rest of it. So the way that life works at the moment is a nice little small farm, dabbling away at the darts and keep the wolf from the door, and everything's happy. But Barry Bishop has actually offered me a little ride on the Isle of Wight if I want to go to the skid school over there. But yeah, I've not been brave enough to tell the wife yet. Now she knows, that's the problem. But I won't be going. As lovely an offer that Barry's made, I probably won't be going.
Yeah, I do look at it. I've looked at it before and I thought, yeah, it'd be really good fun to do that. And then the other part of me thinks, do you know what? But if you went over on your ankle, or your knee or something like that, it's just like, you know, that's why I'm not a speedway rider.
No, well, me too. I'm just too fat, really. That's the main problem.
There is a hidden side to Scott Mitchell, 2015 BDO World Darts Champion. And that is that your arm is in demand and makes some fairly regular and quite prominent TV appearances. I mean, this obviously must be a great thing, that to be a movie star but not be recognised.
Well, I'm not sure I'm supposed to say, but I'm like the Stig of the darts world. You know, I've thrown darts on Holby City. I've thrown in EastEnders. I've been in the Queen Vic and threw a few as well for them. So, it's like cut and you jump in between Friel Mitchell and Danny Dyer or whatever. Steve McFadden and Danny Dyer, and going at a treble 20, a bullseye, a double, something else. And then they go, right, that's it. Thanks, Scotty. See ya. Off you go. It's quite funny. And you do have to pinch yourself to think that you get to do some of these things. And obviously lately they haven't happened. In the last sort of year, we haven't had anything because of COVID. So I haven't had anything in that sort of line, but it's been a lot of fun. A lot of fun. You meet an awful lot of people.
Sort of like a stunt arm.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, when I first went to EastEnders, the first time I went to EastEnders, Barbara Windsor was filming her last scenes. I was there my first day on a Monday. She came in and she wandered in and put her hands on my shoulders. I was sat on a sofa in the green room and she kind of came in the door and put her hands on my shoulders and said, oh, who are you? And I was like, oh my God, this is Barbara Windsor touching me. It was, it was really weird. And I looked around and I said, hi, Baz, I'm just a former darts world champion. I'm throwing a few darts in the Queen Vic for the ladies dart team today. And she said, you throw them exactly where we need them, love. You make us look good. And I looked around at her and I looked over my shoulder and looked at her. And you know what? The only thing that could go through my head, I've seen your boobs in Carry On Camping. That was the first thing that came into my head, and it should never have done. But how many people was that going to be? Everybody would have thought that, surely, wouldn't they? I can't be the only one.
Well, at least it didn't come out of your mouth.
It didn't, no. It was just going through my head. I was thinking, oh, my goodness. What a thing to think. But she was lovely. Well, absolutely. Yeah. When you hear people say how lovely she is, I can say she is. She's lovely.
Ah, good. And it must be a bit different for you, though, being thrust into that world of suddenly being around these household names that you see on TV every day.
I was very nervous about meeting Danny Dyer, actually.
Mm-hmm. But actually, how was that?
He was great. I just had this impression of him. I thought, I'm not going to like him. I'm not going to like him. And he calls me Fatty. Oi, Fatty. Hi, Danny. How you doing? He's it was I ate some food with him when I was there, and he'd ordered some food in, and he said, oi Fatty, come here and eat some food with me. I said, what do you mean? He said, I've got some Chinese, I've got too much here. He said, come and eat some food with me. I said, oi, I might not like it. He said, you do not get that fat without eating Chinese. Come here and sit down. So we came and sat down. No, it's fair, absolutely fair. So we came and sat down and we had a good chat, and he's a really nice guy. You know, obviously he's so busy and we're so busy, you don't ever stay in touch or anything, but it's lovely. It is lovely.
And you also have the unlikely accolade of being a body double for Johnny Depp, if that is still an accolade these days, but nonetheless, a while ago it did happen.
Yeah, I was exactly double his size.
Right.
That's probably what it was. He's only a little man. I reckon I'm double his weight exactly. Yeah, no, we back in 2013, it's funny what comes with getting good with the darts and everything. And there's a period where you're very topical, and I suppose most sportsmen have sort of understood this. And I've had to learn it at a lovely age in my 40s, which is lovely because, you know, a little bit more about life then. If it happened to me in my 20s, I would really think I was the boy, you know. But happening in your 40s, you go, ah, oh, it's lovely what's going on. It's lovely. But, I got asked to do to play, throw some darts on a film set in a film called London Fields. And It was an adaptation of a book by Martin Amis. It was an author. And I had to go sort of varying places in London, which was really cool because I've had no real need to go to London. So I've been a few times with the school and things like that and when I was a kid, but I didn't really, I really am a country boy. So to go to London and go onto these film sets in varying locations around London and throw for varying people, it was pretty cool. And one of the scenes that I had to actually do was stand obviously sideways onto the board with Johnny Depp, with his, I had to crouch down so that I was the same height as him. So I was crouched down because I'm 6'5" and Johnny's 5'8". So I was crouched down to be the same height as him, and he had to back in between my knees with his backside, which is a position a lot of women would love to be in. Johnny Depp backing into them. Not lately, maybe, but that's another court case coming up.
Yeah, I was going to say.
That's another court case coming up. But he backed in, and sort of his bottom was on my crutch. And the film, the way the cinematography is brilliant, because how they managed to block me out with a little 5'8" man, I don't know. But basically they filmed the side of his head and his hand, and he pulled his hand back and I threw the dart past. So it was my arm went through the shot and hit a bullseye for Johnny to win one of the games. And obviously Johnny was quite a humorous fella, and he said, "You enjoying that?" He said, "It took you 3 goes to do it." I said, "Actually, I was surprised I managed to do it in the 3rd attempt. I thought it was going to take 23. But because it's kind of in your spatial zone, it was very weird. But to be on that film set was kind of amazing. There were other sort of guys like Jim Sturgis and people like that in it. It was great. And there was other dart players like Bobby George and things in it as well. So had bit parts, and we had extras parts as ourselves sat in the back. And I wear kind of a flamboyant bright pink and black and what have you shirt. And I was the only one that the sets designers didn't have to have designer shirt for, because mine was loud enough because it was set in the future. So, but it's great, great thing to do. Great thing to anything like that is great to do. We've done other few things as well, but that one's a memorable one.
This is Humans of Speedway. Welcome along. I'm Ian Brannan, and our guest in this episode is a former world darts champion, Scott Mitchell, and also a massive Pool Pirates fan. And he's going to be choosing his all-time team and designing his dream meeting in just a little bit. But let's turn our attention now to your darts career, Scott. And we've spoken on this podcast before about, when it comes to sport, how being an early starter is always really important in order to be successful later in life. However, when it comes to darts, you can disprove that theory, because you were a relatively late starter and still became a world champion.
Yeah, very much so. I didn't start doing the kind of professional circuit till I was like 39 or 40. And wow. A lot of it's circumstance. A lot of it was partly still doing the farm. A lot of it was finding your feet in life. And I started throwing darts at a young age, back in the 70s, when Mum and Dad would go round a friend's house in the village, and they'd take a dartboard up, put it on the back of the kitchen door, and the kids would have a dartboard on a chair somewhere, and we'd throw a dart. Not seriously, but that's probably where I first found out about darts. So, in the 70s, probably, when there wasn't a lot of money around at that time, and I then sort of never really touched a dart, and I started Young Farmers. I don't know if you ever heard of the Young Farmers movement.
Oh, yes.
Down the country. It's it's the most greatest movement. You're there from 10 to 26, and it made me, Young Farmers did. So about 16, maybe, we'd go back to the pub, and I could only drink a Coke then, so we'd go back to our local club, and on a Friday night, all the village were in the pub, and everybody'd be having a game of darts, and you'd put your name up, so you had to learn how to mark a game before you could play. They wouldn't let you play until you could mark a game of darts and count. So I had a few weeks of marking a few games, and then I managed to get on, and I'd get one game, and then I'd get stuffed by the local hero, and I thought, oh, this is getting on my nerves here. I've got to get better at this. So I started to sort of play around about 16 or 17. But of course, as we said earlier, I started riding motocross when I was 18. And so I got good at darts pretty quickly. But I thought that darts was an old man's game, so I could come back to it later. So, whereas motocross, you can't jump on them at 50 years old. Well, there's a few people that are, but so I couldn't. So I didn't start playing county darts till the kids were sort of a bit older and stuff, and I was about 29 or 30. And I just didn't go well at it. I was always a little bit of a nervous sort playing on stage. It just didn't work. And I remember after my fourth time that Dorset had dropped me, they said, you just haven't got it for darts, Scott. You're not going to make it. I've been a manager for 20 years, and I can just see you haven't got it. go home and give it up and enjoy your kids and take them out weekends. Don't come doing this because you just haven't got it. And I was there in tears at like 30 years old going, I'll show you. And yeah, it took me 15 years, but I did.
But what's the journey from playing darts in your local pub or in a local team or league to getting to be the world champion? I mean, what is that journey like?
Well, we started getting sort of like big names come around local pubs around the area, and I was putting on a good show against them and beating one or two of them. So they'd come down and do exhibitions at pubs. And so and a few people, I qualified for a TV tournament called the UK Open in 2007. And it was open, so I played in a little pub in Christchurch and won that round in Dorset. Then I had to go to another round in Somerset, and I won that, and that put me to the TV stages of the UK Open in 2007. And I went on, won two games, and then lost in one of the games to the world champion at the time, Jelle Klaassen. I lost to him 8-4 or 8-5, and yeah, when I came home, all of a sudden there was some people going, we'd like to sponsor you and put you on the BDO circuit. And I resisted for a year. I felt the kids were too young. I resisted for about a year. And then in 2008, I just, you know, they were still hounding me a little bit. And I decided to sort of go on the circuit right at the end of 2008, which gave me a full year to get to the 2010 BDO World Championships. And that's exactly what I did. So I was very fortunate to get those sponsors I played my first World Championships in 2010.
For the passive darts watcher, like many people do, you know, they enjoy the annual Ali Pally and maybe the Premier League darts and maybe the Lakeside one as well, of course, the BDO that you won. But there's much more to darts than that. It's a year-round thing. There's tournaments constantly and tournaments happening that are not screened on TV in small venues, hotels, like where you are, that you're speaking to us right now. You're getting ready to take part in one of those events. What is it like? And how demanding is it to be a darts player?
Yeah, with the BDO, it was worse than that. We were travelling to Spain, you know, Germany, Belgium, France, Denmark, Holland, Sweden. We were having to do a full circuit, which was quite expensive to do for three tournaments a year that were on the TV, so that we could sort of put ourselves out there and sell ourselves. So yeah, it was more difficult. Whereas the PDC is more based in the UK, it's more sort of northern. It's Barnsley and Wigan. Most of the pro tours are played, and we've played one at Milton Keynes, and obviously now we're here at Coventry. So yeah, it's a difficult thing to do with the BDO. You just jump on it and you have a chance to qualify. With the PDC, you have to get a tour card and be in the top 128 before you can sort of qualify for a lot of the TV tournaments. So I had to go to this Q school in January of this year. And unfortunately, I failed to get in the top 24 to obtain a tour card. So I've been on the lower tour this year, which is called the Challenge Tour. And the Challenge Tour sort of, again, is based in England. And we've had 10 Challenge Tour events this year, which I ended up finishing fifth. I have about 700, but that still wasn't enough to get me a tour card. The top two got a tour card. So I've got to go back to Q school next year. But the advantage of being in the Challenge Tour at number 5, it means every time on the Pro Tour, which is the one above, people miss out. Like, I believe this weekend, Michael van Gerwen's missing out with a back injury. So as soon as somebody from the top one misses out, they go down to the number one at the Challenge Tour and promote them in to get them into the system. And I'm at number 5 this weekend, and I've been promoted in, and I've been to all of them all year because I was at number 1 most of the year. So it's very difficult. It's very difficult at this level because the level in the PDC is higher. The standard is higher. There's a lot more players doing the averages. And of course, I'm still working, where a lot of the players, you know, the top 20 players are all professionals. So when you go against them, they've been practicing sort of 4 or 5 hours a day. And I've been lucky to get sort of 3 hours a week in with the farm. Mm. So, you know, and I've been moving 1,000 little bales of hay on a certain day. And the last thing you want to do is go and pick up a 25-gram dart and throw it at a board. So, you know, there's reasons and ways, but it is what it is. And like I say, I feel really fortunate that we've been able to play at all this year. So, you know, I'm trying to progress and trying to get that tour card so that I can try and get into the elitist part of the sport before I get too old.
Yeah, well, we'd love to see you out there, and hopefully with fans back in, of course, next year as well is obviously the hope, and fingers crossed that can, you know, get back to normal, because that's part of the thing with the darts, isn't it? It's the atmosphere of the crowd behind you.
It's amazing. You take people to the darts that have never been to darts, don't even like darts, and they'll go to a darts evening and learn it through the evening as it goes on, and they come home, and I've taken people with me as guests, you know, sponsors that have sponsored me and haven't had a lot to do with darts, and they come out of Lakeside and they go, wow, I really want to do this again. The atmosphere is absolutely amazing, and it is as a fan. Even the nights that I wasn't playing at Lakeside, I'd like to go and sit in the crowd and watch my mates play. It was just a fantastic atmosphere, and the fans make that, and it's the same with Speedway. The fans make it, and that you've got to have them in there, and it's hard to motivate yourself to play well when the fans aren't there.
In the previous episode that we did in Humans of Speedway, we spoke to Gary Havelock, who was the 1992 World Speedway Champion, as you will be well aware. And in that, when he was talking about winning the World Championship, he sort of alluded to the fact that he kind of knew he had it won, you know, fairly early doors in that meet, and he knew that was his night, and if he didn't do it that night, then who knows what would have happened another night. I mean, did you feel like that when you were taking part in that tournament? Obviously, it was over a number of days, but were you confident in yourself that you knew that you had it in the bag, or did the nerves get to you in a different way?
To be honest, I felt very confident. You've got to have a bit of confidence to go to play any sport, and I'd had the most amazing 2014. I'd won six or seven tournaments. I'd gone in I was either winning a tournament or going out early. So if I could get a couple of games under my belt, it was good. So I remember putting the bag in the car when we left home the Friday night to travel up to Lakeside. And I said to my wife, Sharon, I put the case in the boot and I said, you know what, if I don't win this World Championships this year, I'll never win it. And that was the confidence that I had going into it, and I was very relaxed. I wasn't worried about any game. It was just everything was happening the way that I thought it would be, and I was going to sudden death deciders and winning last legs, but I had the confidence to win them. And you know, and I'd had years, probably I think six or seven times before, I'd been knocked out first round three times, my first three attempts, and then the next 2 years I got knocked out second round. So it wasn't like I had any form at Lakeside. I think people were backing me at 80-1, sort of like at the start of the week, and some people made some good money on me that week.
And you made some good money as well. I mean, what do you do with £100,000 worth of winnings other than buy a tractor?
Yeah, my dad had, I don't remember my dad ever having a new tractor, and I thought that the money would get me a new one, but I was that out of touch that no, it didn't. So I went and bought him a new second-hand one, very new, nothing that we'd ever had before, one that starts on the key. You didn't have to tow it with another one or leave it on a hill to bump start it, which was what we were touring around in our old wreckers, which are fun, but yeah, they're not fun when you're in a hurry. I bought my dad a tractor, which then saw me on Countryfile, you know, Helen Skelton was a reporter at Lakeside, and I said in the semi-final, she said, so what happens if you get home with all this money? I said, I'll buy my dad a new tractor. And that was the daftest thing I'd ever said. And the only thing that my dad had ever remembered that I'd said, funny enough, because I said lots of things to him in the past, he'd forgotten them, but he remembered that I said, I'll buy him a new tractor. So, when I won it, you know, all of a sudden I've got all the local tractor dealers on the phone. It was quite funny. It was quite funny, so I knew that they'd all been watching as well.
Yeah, here's a man that's in the market for a new tractor and he's got the
absolutely
cash.
Absolutely. So Helen Skelton was on Countryfile at the time. She was a reporter, and she said, if you get this tractor for your dad, I want it on Countryfile. I said, and I want to come down to Dorset and be there when it comes. I said, you're welcome to. So then we sourced a tractor and that kind of happened. So I'm on Countryfile on a Sunday night being watched by 12 million people or 10 million people, I think it was that night. Yeah, only 4.5 million had watched me hit the winning double in a World Championship. And I throw a set of keys at my dad for a tractor, and 10 million people are watching me on Countryfile on a Sunday evening. So that was a bit of a head mess. You know, how does that work? So, but yeah, loved it. It was best thing.
Helen Skelton came and was on work experience at a radio station I used to work at when she was, you know, just at university or whatever. And so it's quite weird seeing her on the TV.
She's crazy
now.
She's mad and lovely, isn't she? She's just a lovely person.
Yeah. Oh, she was great. I remember we had like some kind of staff night out, and she was still like the work experience kid. And yeah, she was all over us. It was great.
No, it was good.
Her brother's was a professional footballer as well.
Oh right, okay.
Her brother used to play in Scotland.
Yeah, and I know she's with Richie, he's with Lee Rhinos now. So
yeah,
Richie Myatt.
Small world, isn't it?
Indeed.
Okay, well, on to Speedway then, and we've sort of touched on how you got involved in Speedway. You're a regular fan. I mean, how often do you get down there sort of these days? I mean, 2020 accepted, but let's go back to last year.
Every week, yeah. I don't miss.
It was
lovely. You know, I've become friends with Matt Ford and Danny Ford, so they're obviously promoting the place and have done for the last few years, and that was going on before I was a world champion, if I'm totally honest. After I'd been to a couple of lakesides and I walked in and, you know, I've done a few things down there at Poole as well with Matt. And it just, you know, it's my club. It's, you know, I've gone through the turnstiles at 2 weeks old. It's just kind of amazing. It's, you know, I remember not all the riders because you don't, but, you know, it's crazy. I go gaga when I met Roscoe and people like that. You know, how do you go gaga when you meet Alan Rossiter? But they were my heroes. They were my people that were, you know, belting around that track, trying to win trophies for our club. And, you know, and I've got to meet a few of them now. And obviously where I've got in the sport, everybody knows that I've been a world champion. And now, you know, I stand in different places. I get to stand by the pits. And Midlow was one of my heroes as a kid. And now he's one of my mates. I bought a mini digger off him about 3 years ago, you know. And it's just... I have to pinch myself to think that I'm lucky enough to get what I do. And last season I was actually doing some commentary for Rerun. For Steve at Rerun. So I was going out and interviewing the riders, and obviously it's a little bit easier for me because some of the riders know who I am, so they're always quite happy to stop and chat. And had some good fun with Nikolai Clint. We just didn't talk Speedway hardly ever. and I managed to get on the Rerun DVD, so you know, with my bloopers, the bloopers one at the end of the year for about 5 minutes with all the mistakes I was making, because it's just not natural. But I absolutely loved every minute of it. So that was, you know, it was good fun. You know, 2019 was really good fun. I really enjoyed that season, although we didn't do as well as we would hope, but as a team. But for me. You know, getting out onto that, the only time I'd ever been on the centre green was probably in the 70s when there was a bomb scare. And I remember Dad throwing me over the fence, and then a couple of years ago, you know, Matt said, "Would you want to come out on the centre green and watch a race?" I'm like, "Oh my God." And I feel like that every time I get out to go on the centre green. It's it is amazing. It's an amazing feeling. And I'm like a kid in a candy store when I get to Poole. It excites me, the place, even driving by it in December. And there's nobody there. But yeah, it's either in you or it isn't, you know.
You alluded to it just briefly and mentioned a couple of riders, Roscoe and Midlow. But which riders were you huge fans of when you were growing up and in those formative years when you were getting into Speedway as a youngster?
Yeah, Roscoe was sort of in the 80s. Obviously, when we were down in second division, he was Captain Marvel, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He had plenty to say for himself. If any of the fans didn't like it, he'd give it back, and I kind of liked that. And you know, in the 70s, it was Super Simo, and but I was only very young then. I was only 8 or 9, and so you know, we had all those little Britain Speedway toys then, and mine would always have a number one on the back. I'd paint on the back, and it'd be Simo, and just riders like him. Eric Broadbelt was a bit of a crazy man. We liked him. And it just kind of went on through, and Boise was great, and I met Boise, and like I say, I get to know Roscoe now. Roscoe keeps asking me for dartboards now because he's got a pub. So, me and Roscoe get on with that, and I go to Swindon as well. If I've got the time to be able to jump in the car after work and get up to Swindon, I go to Swindon as well now, the last couple of years to meetings when I can get there. So, it's been, the last 3 or 4 years have been amazing. I've really loved it since being world champion. It's just opened up a few things, and so those were the kind of riders, and then up to modern day sort of Chris and Darcy and Jack. Bjarne Pedersen was another favourite of mine. Mr. Loyal to Paul, he was amazing. So I know them all, and you know, it's quite weird.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of the previous episodes, actually, that we've done, we've sort of had conversation about various riders that have been involved in pool. And if people haven't checked them out yet, definitely worth listening to the Roy Clark episode that we did, because Bjarne Pedersen used to live at his house.
Yeah.
And there's a few stories there about him and fellow Danes. And also, we had Gary Havelock on the last one, and, you know, he was saying about what a well-run club pool is, and how, you know, ever since Matt Ford took over, you know, it's been the Matt Ford Midlow partnership, and what a difference that's made since they took over at the club.
Massively, massively. They are our Eric and Ernie, or, you know, they are really, they're a double act, they're a double tit, their team. You know, Midlow's been the winningest manager in the recent times, and obviously Matt's been the promoter that's brought the trophies. And I have a saying that in Matt we trust, you know, and he's brought in riders and thinking, who the hell is this guy? And then he just goes out there and rides this bike like he stole it. And I don't know who's given the tip off. But these guys have come, you know, like Vaclav Milik, and people going, who the hell is this fella?
Yeah.
Oh my, he's a nutter. He's brilliant, you know. And he kept pulling these ones out of the bag and kept pulling them out of the bag. And, you know, I think even in the last few years, I think when we signed Nikolai Klint, I think a few people sort of raised their eyebrows a bit. But I think Nikolai was great for us because he's a great team man. And I think Paul were great for him in helping him get back on track to where he needed to be. He was he's another one of my friends. He's a good guy. We've had a good few years, and you know, we just want to get back out on track and see if we can have another few.
And you wore the Pool Pirates emblem on your shirt, didn't you?
Yes, I still do. I've always, you know, a lot of people have a sponsor on their left arm, and I don't. I have the skull and crossbones. It's always with me, and my replica shirts get printed with them on, and you know, it's but that's how my friendship. I've become very friendly. The club is a community club. Pool is a club that you know we've. In the last few years, they've been doing like five-a-side football tournaments on the centre green before the game and before the matches, and things like that. You know, the club want the community involved, and they try to promote it the best way they can. And Matt does a great job at that.
This is Humans of Speedway. Scott Mitchell, 2015 BDO World Darts Champion, is with us. He's a massive Pool Pirates fan, and he's going to be designing his dream Speedway meeting very soon in our Speedway Paradise section. Right now, some questions. I put a little thing on social media just before we recorded this, and a few questions for you, if you can give us the answers, Scott. The first one comes from Michelle Tucker. Do you know Michelle?
Yes, I do know Michelle,
right.
Yeah.
Put yourself in this position. The Pirates need a 5-1 in Heat 15. Which pairing do you choose? Darcy Ward and Chris Holder, or Lee Adams and Tony Rickardson?
Oh, Michelle. Really? I'd have to go Darcy and Chris. Because it would be... We would need Lee to trap it, and Tony would do the rest. But I think Chris and Darcy would probably let the other two go, and then catch him for the entertainment value. I think.
Okay.
That's
so
probably
based
what
on
they'd
entertainment
done.
Value.
I think on the entertainment value, I think Darcy and Chris may have been slightly more entertainment, slightly only because Lee Adams would trap it and go. He was such a good gator, so. There would be no entertainment from Lee, he'd just be gone. And Tony would do the work to do it. I don't really know. She knows what she was doing there. Thanks for that, Michelle. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, she knew you were putting you in an impossible position, but she does say, see you in March.
Absolutely, my love. See you in March.
And who's this one? Stuart in Manchester. Is it true David Essex was your father Christmas at school?
No, it was at my Sunday school. We had a Sunday school in our village, yes, when I was a youngster. And so the lady that ran the Sunday school was actually our neighbouring farmer, Margaret Creighton. And so my mum would push me and my brother off to Sunday school on a Sunday morning. Margaret would come and pick us up, and this Sunday school sort of Christmas party she had at her house, and it turned out that her daughter had met David Essex in a pub somewhere local to us, and David Essex turned up and was our father Christmas, handed out the Christmas presents at our Sunday school Christmas party. It was around the time that he was in Silver Dream Racer in 1981 maybe.
Yeah, he was big around then.
Massive
wasn't
film.
Yeah.
It was massive in the day. And I think it was not long, it was either just before or just after that, because my dad was on their farm helping him, teaching him how to ride a motorbike for the Silver Dream Racer movie.
Oh,
they had a little,
wow.
They had a little, I don't know, an old, I don't know what it was, a Honda 185 or something field bike, and they were just teaching him how to ride it. So yeah, so that was opposite our house. So yeah, that's, I met him after that as well.
Wow, if only David Essex had taken up Speedway, eh? We could be having a different conversation.
I'm not so sure from the way when he was learning that he would have been able to do it, to be honest. No disrespect, David, if you're listening, but yeah.
If David Essex is listening to this, I'll be very impressed and shocked.
You never know. You just never know with this World Wide Web business.
Exactly. You do never know. What would be the best atmosphere that you've experienced at both a darts and a Speedway event? And which would be the best one? So I guess you've been to Cardiff and so on. Have you?
Yeah, I've been to Cardiff. Unfortunately, I've been to Cardiff nearly every year. And two of the years I missed, Chris Holder won and Chris Harris won. That was the 2 years I missed because I was playing darts, unfortunately. We had a tournament on that weekend, and when you have sponsors helping you out to get where you go, you've got to do the right thing. So, I went to the thing. So I think Cardiff is the most amazing atmosphere, but I've got to say, in 2018, when Chris Harris passed Jason Doyle, turn three against Somerset, Paul against Somerset, I've never seen anything like it. The crowd, nowhere near the crowd that you see at a GP or whatever, and just the elation of we thought we were going to Golden Eats. We, you know, nobody had ever done that. Even Kelvin was commentating. They thought they were going to Golden Eats, and where Bomber got that pass from, I don't know. And I just remember being out. I was actually stood by the pits that night, and there's a fence that goes along the pits that's about 6 or 8 foot high, and I managed to get on top of it. The adrenaline, I jumped up, managed to get my leg over it, and I'm sat on top of the fence. 8 foot high. I don't know. You want to see me? I'm a lump. If you asked me to get over it for a tenner, I wouldn't do it. But somehow that night, with the adrenaline of what was going on, I managed to jump and sit on the top of it. Just the most amazing scenes, because that was, you know, what it was like for the club and everything. And obviously, for me, it was winning the World Championship and hitting that winning double and turning around, and the crowd cheered so loudly that their breath in Lakeside hit me like somebody blowing a heater, like a hairdryer in your face. If you turn a hairdryer around and blow that on full hot in your face, when I turned round and the crowd were cheering, that was what came and hit me. Talk about COVID. I'm pleased it wasn't around then. But, you know, it was the most, I'll never forget that. Not the moment of just hitting it, the moment of turning round and going, oh my God, I've won. And that breath, that it was like a draft of wind hit me, of hot air, of people cheering towards me, and those are probably two moments that I'll take to the grave of me for sure. Best one with Bomber is the fact that he was all taking all the plaudits and all the interviews in the thing, and I was out the back loading his van up. I was putting his bikes away, yeah, because his mechanic at the time, Matt Reed, was my mate, is a friend of ours, and a family friend, and obviously he was a racer until his big accident when he was 24 a few years ago now, and spent himself in a coma for 7 months. And Matt's a good friend, and Matt and Claire are friends of the family. So Matt was bannering for Chris that night, and so while he was in there having all the interviews and Sky were all over him, this, that and the other, I was chucking all the tools in the van and wheeling bikes back to his van, having it load up so that when he could come out, he could go home.
Oh, there you go.
I'm nice like that, see? I've touched a Speedway bike, I just can't get on one. I'm allowed to touch them and push them, but I'm not allowed to ride them.
Oh, well, it's the safest way, I would say.
Yeah, I'm not even safe for pushing them, really, but there we go.
Let's move on to the Speedway Paradise section of our chat then, because we do this with every guest that we've had on, and it started off as a sort of a more brief chat at the end, but it's sort of become a little bit more in depth depending on where we go, because What we're going to ask you to do really is choose your dream 1-7, the track you would race on, the stadium you put that in, referee, you can change a rule, it's entirely up to you, blank canvas, but the idea is to sort of create your own virtual dream speedway meeting, and I suspect Poole will be a big influence in this.
But massively, yeah.
let's start off then with the track that you would have this raced on. I mean, we're not talking about the surrounding facilities, this is purely the shale, the racetrack and the shape. I mean, where would we have it?
Well, I do love the National Speedway Stadium track. I think it produces great racing. But because we've already got that in the UK, because it's my fantasy, I want two tracks like that in the UK. So yeah. I would probably pick Torren up and put it smack bang in middle of Wimborne Road. That's what I would do with that. I would put the Torren track in the middle of Wimborne Road, I think. We've all watched the GPs from there and seen how brilliant that track is. So my fantasy would be to have that track right there in Poole.
Well, if the Greyhounds are moving out, I mean, you might have the space.
Well, that's another subject, isn't it? We could be here all night on these things. We will wait and see. It was on there at one point, back a few years back. So you never know. It could be again.
And I mean, for me, I grew up as a Halifax and a Bradford fan, and Torren's based on Bradford quite heavily because Per Jonsson designed it, and big banked bends, that's what you need in speedway, there's not enough of them.
No, I agree with that and but at the moment I'm feeling this is a daft thing because I just want speedway, I don't care what track it's on, I just want to see some live stuff. But yeah,
just down the cycle speedway would be a start.
Absolutely.
Okay, your dream 1-7 then. Now, this can be any rider from any era, alive or not, no points limits. It's entirely up to you. Seven of the best
this
from
you.
This
is so hard because okay. There are probably friends that I'm leaving out that I would love to have in, but there are reasons for every single one. And my number one without doubt would be Super Simo. It would be Malcolm Simmons. I just loved him as a kid. And he I just idolised him. And I even had a spell where I was running around picking up the free golf stickers that they were handing out with the programmes that people were dropping on the floor at Wimborne Road. And I stuck them all over my dad's car, much to his disgust at the time. His Hillman Avenger was covered in golf stickers because of Simo. But so Simo was my absolute hero. Number two is another kind of hero, and I spoke about how we'd done a few grass tracks and things back in the day, and this is where I first saw Simon Wigg, and he was just so cool. You look at a picture of Simon Wigg and his equipment now, it still looks modern, it still looks up to date, and I still feel that, like, the sponsorship side of things, he made a big turning point in the way that British riders looked at the racing and how to bring in sponsors. He was just immaculate, and I never really met him as a person, so I don't know what he was like as a person, but as a rider and a racer, I really liked him, you know, the blonde locks coming out the back of the lid and everything. He just had everything for me.
Yeah, well, he rode at Bradford for a while, so I mean, and he was incredible. It was like, I think it was about 1990 or 1991, I think he was racing there. And as you say, just the branding, you know, his van looked immaculate, his bikes looked immaculate, everything was, you know, colour coordinated. And he was, I mean, I didn't know him or don't know him personally, and obviously never will now, but you know, from other people who have mentioned him in their teams, have all said, you know, what a great guy he was as well, you know, off the track, and a great guy to have in the team.
Yeah. So for that reason alone, and I still look things up on YouTube and still watch some of his races and picture archives, and I just think he still looks so cool. So yeah. He was the reason at number two. Number three, I couldn't not have Bruce Pennell in my team. As a kid, I was just amazed by him, and there was a lot of hype around Bruce, wasn't there? And it was so good when he came to Wimborne Road with Cradley or whatever. It was so exciting. That the place was packed. He really did put bums on seats, and I was probably 11 or 12 years old around the time that sort of like Bruce was winning his world championships and stuff, and you know, the Speedway was on TV a lot then, a little bit like the darts. You know, it was on, and the link for the darts and the Speedway for me was obviously Dave Lennon as well. But yes. That's another story. But Bruce was, you know, again, like Wiggy, immaculately turned out. You know, he was stars and trites. There was just razzmatazz about Bruce. And everything that he did, you know, you'd see him arriving in a helicopter on a meeting on the telly or whatever, and it was superstar stuff, which we'd kind of never really seen the like of that before, I don't believe, in such a big way with the media. No. We'd seen riders that are probably as good and as famous or whatever, but Bruce took it to another level. So I would always have Bruce in the team. Number four, obviously. We had a great time with Tony Ricarton at Poole, and you know, he Matt says he was a really important signing for him, you know, for turning the club around as well, and he was just amazing for us at Poole, and again, you just couldn't wait to get through the turnstiles to see him every week, and I think most people felt the same. And I was at Cardiff the year that he went round and seemed to ride halfway up the air fence, sort of like, yes, Ice Speedway style, and go on and win the meet. And I just go on and win the race, and that was the final. I still can't get over how he did that. But that's Tony as a motorbike person, and he's always been my team. So I've got him at number four, and then at number five I've got Jason Crump. We had him as a really raw young man when he came to Poole. And he sort of like followed the lines of the Australians of Boise and people like that. So he came in and was absolute, just wanted to win. He's just a born winner. And he wanted to win every race. It was, you know, he'd come in a bit stroppy, and if he hadn't won, and if you want to epitomise what being a winner is about and how meticulous he was. And I think Jason was just great. I think he was great for World Speedway. I don't think he was just great for us at Poole for the time that he was there. He's great for World Speedway. And you look at the hype of him, you know, he would have been riding for Bellevue this year. How great would that have been? You know, what a coup that would have been to have him in our league this year. But sadly, unfortunately, it wasn't to be. So you get to number five, and then you've got to go, well, my two reserves are probably Chris Older at number six and Darcy Ward at number seven, mainly because they're the Turbo Twins and we absolutely love them. I've been very fortunate enough to meet Chris, and on a few occasions I've actually been up to his house, done a bit of chain iron, a bit of grass cutting for him, baled some hay and stuff at his place and took it home for my wife. So Chris is a friend, and he's quite a shy guy off the track, off the sort of, you know, we see him on camera being sort of like happy-go-lucky, but when he's off the track, he's sometimes a little bit shy, and which is quite sort of unbelievable to think, really. Or he was when he was around me. And of course, Darcy was probably pulled off some of the finest overtaking moves that I've ever seen in there. And they're only at number six and seven because they're the youngest of my bunch. I put them in the reserve spot. So I think they're just, Darcy is such a loss to the club. It hurt Speedway. It reminded us of what can happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Lee Richardson did as well. He was with the club as well. That was very sad. And what's happened to Darcy is sad as well. So, but he would always have to be in my team. And if I could have a mascot, I'd probably have Mark Moran as the club mascot, just to go out and do a few laps at the start, because obviously it's my fantasy world. And I'm allowed to do what I want. And my two managers, I think that Dan Ford and Matt Ford got it right this year. I'd have two managers. I'd have Midlow and I'd have Javi as managers. So I was looking forward to that double act this year, wasn't meant to be. So I'd have them as my team managers.
Well, hopefully you'll be able to see them in action next year, because I know from speaking to Javi a few weeks ago when we did the chat with him then, I think that is still the plan going forward for 2021. So fingers crossed, you will get that dream at least.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it. And I obviously want to try and do some away meetings so that I can see Javi in action in the pits. I've only had... Brandon did the walk for Darcy to raise money for him, and I did the last I did the second last 10 miles. So I walked from Chepstow to Newport with him that year. And when we got to the other end, and we'd all stayed in a Premier Inn, and I got to meet Javi and a few people. We had something to eat after the walk, after I got rid of all the blisters on my feet, and I staggered downstairs. I don't know why I said I'd do it, but I thought I could walk 10 miles, but it was tough. And Steve would walk from King's Lynn all the way to Cardiff, you know, day after day, yeah. Which was just amazing. All for Darcy, obviously. And I got to meet Javi, and I had a great conversation with Javi about the proportion of people on the table that had ordered chunky chips and the ones that had ordered skinny chips. And was it the chunky people that had ordered chunky chips, and was it the skinny people that had ordered skinny chips? And I think that kind of sums Javi up for me.
Important question.
Interested in everything. He takes interest in what's going on around him. He's into everything. And that was a great conversation. So I'd love to be in the pits when he's chatting to his lads. So hopefully next season I can get to do that and go to an away one and have a listen in. That'd be lovely.
I think he's planning to get to a few of the home meetings as well. He's definitely going to try and get there. He said that to me.
Again, anyway, I feel sad that I've left him out of the team, which is why I've sort of made
him
the
manager.
Yeah, well, he's in now. He's in as a. But I mean, you know, I've left people like Mark Baram out, Hans Anderson, Bjarne, Brady, Jack. It's just, I just couldn't fit them all in.
Malcolm Simmons, Simon Wigg, Bruce Pennell, Tony Rickardson, Jason Crump, Chris Holder, Darcy Ward, Mark Loram as the mascot, Midlow and Javi team managers. So you've got, what, four world champions and probably, four world champions, and probably Darcy Ward would have won it at least once or twice, if not probably many more.
And I think Wiggy was a long track world champion. So
he was a long track, yeah. And Javi was world champion, of course. So, yeah. And Mark Loram. So
So poor old Midlow. My dear mate that I've been to golf with a couple of Travis Perkins days. I can't do that to him. But he was the best manager. Don't forget that. He's won loads of trophies as a manager. That's the thing.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
He's made up for it.
If we're going to have a referee for this meeting, I don't know what your knowledge of referees is like, but who do you choose?
Yeah, with the age of, we've got to have somebody that knows the modern day speedway and knows a bit of the background of the old day speedway as well, because I think, there would be a few altercations maybe, and I've gone for Tony Steele.
Yes,
Tony Steele. He's still safe pair of hands. He's spade to spade with Tony. He won't be budged. I've got to know him, and he's taken me. Actually, he took me in the ref's box at the start of 2019. I said, "Have you ever seen what a ref does?" I said, "No," and he was. He was training a ref, and I went and sat in there, and it was lovely because it was a freezing night. And it was lovely to be sat up there, penned up, four of us in the ref box. It was lovely. It was lovely and warm. And I did not realise the of what a ref has to do. I just thought he had to press the button to get the tapes up. And it was just an absolute eye-opener. And I wish every fan could go up there and see what a ref has to do. The implications of... We all see it at Paul Nigel out on the centre green announcing the time and the riders and this, that and the other. But he can only do that once it's been confirmed from the referee. So the referee then confirms that down with Nigel. And then they're sort of like getting ready for the next race. They're then timing from the end of that race to the next race so that they get the next lot of riders out. And when the 2 minutes comes on, and if there's been an incident on the track or a crash, then... They have to make sure that the track's safe again straight away, and sometimes they have to come out of the box and check the track themselves with their own eyes, or they leave it to the clerk of the course who says, it was a minor incident, nothing's been done, bang a new air fence in, and that's that. And how much they have to do before the meeting as well to walk the track and check its, validity, I suppose, for the meeting. So a lot of responsibility falls down on the referees, and I don't think we as fans actually... totally understand that, but Tony Steele would be the man for the job for me.
Yeah, and all that, and no replays allowed either. So it's all based on what they've seen, there and then.
So you've got to know what you're looking for. And I think that I was going to go with Christina. I could have gone with Christina, but I just plumped for Tony. I think his hairstyle just took it for me. I think. Tony's white afro that he's got going on. He's just a great guy, Tony, and he deserves. I want him reffing my team.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of love for Tony Steele, I think. Probably the most requested referee, I think, in this feature, I would say, over the time so far. The one rule you would change if you were to be getting involved in the rule book and affecting Tony's day, I mean, what would be the one rule you'd tweak?
It's probably the same one that everybody else has probably said, and it's, as a fan, I'm frustrated about this movement at the start, rubbish.
Yes.
You know, can we not just go back to if you touch the tapes, you're out? If you want to move, you move. You know, let's make sure that they're up tight to tapes. If there is a slight movement from there, if they haven't touched the tapes, just let it go. You know, that's a good start, isn't it?
The question has been mentioned a few times about why are we still using tapes in 2020? Mm. You know, is there a more sort of technical
like a lights out in Formula One type thing?
Yeah, and transponders, see who's moving, and you'll get an instant feedback of who moved.
There's a certain element across again attached to that, and can you do that at grassroots level? Because whatever you do, they've got to be trained to do that from the time they get on a bike, so that it's fair.
Sure.
So, but that's the only rule. I want to find. There's got to be an answer to this. So many sort of, you know, if you move at the start, you shouldn't be penalised for trying to jump the start. As long as everybody's front wheel is in the right place, and they've only got 2 inches or 3 inches to move, then that's good. And if not, the riders, you know, we see so many refs pull the riders up, then the riders roll back 6 inches. Well, that for me, you've got to be excluded for that. And if you start doing it and you keep catching it, then riders will stop doing it.
It's interesting. I had a chat with Phil Morris, and he's big on this. He's done a lot of research into starts. And he's found that the duration that riders are held for from the green light going on to the tapes going up over the last, I don't know how many years, 3 or 4 years, has got shorter and shorter and shorter. So that's why riders are now anticipating it, because the referees are not holding them as long. And I think he's all for having a sort of a randomised thing on the button that the ref presses it, and then there's like a delay that then before the tapes go up.
Oh, so I see, with technology, have a random like a randomizer with a delay. That's a good idea, actually.
Because you can have like between 1 and 6 seconds or whatever it is you can hold them for.
It's what we used to do with motocross starts. It used to be that way. The 5 second ball goes round and it can go down in 1 second or it could go down in five. And you'd see people anticipate it. And obviously with a motocross start, you go under the gate. So the minute that everybody else's will drop and yours won't, because your front wheel will have it jammed. I don't ever see that ever working in Speedway, because you can't have bits of metal on the track. That's just not on. It caused Tony Steele a lot of problem. So, but that's what happens in motocross. You penalise yourself. And there's no way of kind of doing that with a Speedway start, unfortunately. Otherwise, I think it would be a lot easier to deal with.
Yeah, it needs a bit of work, but I think there's certainly something perhaps in that. But I guess it'll be a long road before that gets changed.
Absolutely.
Just anybody, just getting bikes on the track at the minute is a bit of a feat. So that's the rule you'd change. And the final question really is: a team from any time in history, from any league in the world, to be the opposition. Now, this is a complete team which has existed. So who would be the opposition, do you think?
Now, I'm probably thinking right out of the window here, because people, and I've kind of stated how I liked a bit of razzmatazz around the Speedway. I would have picked a USA test side from like the early 80s. Unfortunately, I can't pick one because I put Bruce in my team. So it's going to have to be just after 82 then, by the sounds of it, when he went off to Chips. So I mean the likes, you know, so the likes of, you know, you're talking Bobby Schwartz, Dennis Segalos, John Cook, who else? Lance King, Scott Autry, Steve Gresham, Rick Miller, who does it? Kelly Moran, Sean Moran, who doesn't want to see them? You know, so I would love to have. I remember the test sides coming to Paul, and there was just, like I say, everybody wanted to go. You know, it was 6, 7, 8 deep. It was promoter's dream, really, if you could manage to get one of the test matches. So that's what it felt like as a kid at the time. And so any of those guys turning out and riding against Bruce, don't forget. So that would have been really exciting in my fantasy world. Sudden Sam as well. Sam Emelianenko would have been just about starting around that
Sam
time.
So they
had a mass to pick from. And I think, funny enough, in the 90s, then the Aussies kind of did the same, didn't they? It was the Aussie influx then come in. You know, your Boyce's, your Jono's, your Ryan Sullivan's, your Lee Adams, and You know, so I think, but for me, those American teams at the time were amazing, and I think that would, you know, that would be a meeting I would love to see with that team that I've picked riding against. You know, what would Darcy and Chris be like riding those guys from the 80s, you know, from America? It's what a meeting you'd have. You'd have entertainment and the interviews as well, I think.
Would they all be riding the would the Americans be riding the bikes of their era, or would they be
on
the equal?
I think they would, and I think what we would do, because I think that the likes of Tony, Jason, Chris and Darcy would ride anything. I think that they would have to ride bikes of their era as well. But we mustn't forget in their era. I was actually watching a bit because of knowing about the interview today. I was watching a bit on YouTube today, and Simo had to pull out of one of the meetings because he blew his engine up, and he only had one bike.
Ah.
So back in those days, you had one bike, so he couldn't take no further part. So the reserve had to ride. So yeah,
right, yeah.
So and I think Jeremy Doncaster, and one of the ones I was watching today, done something to his bike and wrapped it around a post or something, and he was riding Wiggy's bike for the rest of the meeting. And it's just, you just don't see that often these days, do you?
No, you don't. You don't. And you don't. Well, we don't really see too many you know, touring matches anymore.
No,
either, do we?
No, that's another attraction, I think, for me. Yeah. I would pay damn good money to go and see that lineup anywhere.
Scott, you've really run with the old fantasy speedway idea. You've actually added another element to the list of questions, which I think is a very good point, because your meeting is going to be televised. So you've actually picked your dream commentator, and if actually a commentating duo, to commentate on this great speedway match, and two great speedway commentating names.
Well, absolutely. I would definitely have Dave Lanning as my commentator, because he was the one that linked Speedway and darts for me at a young age. And I'd met Dave on a few occasions. And actually, about 3 weeks before I won the World Championships, he wrote in the local Echo that I hadn't performed as I should, and I should have been a world champion by then. And I had 3 weeks where I was really horrible. I was thinking, I'm going to show you. And at the end of the week, I won it. And he was the first one to send out the Echo reporter, interviewed me after the meeting, after the final. And he said, Scotty, by the way, Dave Lanning texted me and sent his regards and said, well done, boy, you've finally done it. And That's Dave Lanning all over for you. 15 minutes after I just won the World Championship, he sent a message through the Echo where he sort of berated me a bit and said I hadn't performed. So he went from being my zero for a bit to my hero again. So I would definitely have Dave Lanning. I'd love to have him looking at the Americans, saying, you know, some of his greats said, this is a team that, you know, is not frightened to get into a gallop, or you know, Bruce Pennell was riding out of his jockstrap. We just need some of that back again. It's great stuff. And yeah, he would definitely be. I'd definitely have Nigel as well. There's no two ways about that. But yeah, Dave Lanning and Nigel would do the meeting for me without doubt for commentary.
Wow, Dave Lanning and Nigel Pearson together. It's and both, of course, darts and speedway link. So you got it. Everything
it works
covered
for
there.
Me. Definitely, it works for me.
Well, look, thanks for spending the time and joining us on this episode, Scott. It's been lovely talking to you, and some great stories. And hopefully, you know, it won't be too long before we can all get back to a speedway track and get watching the sport that we all love.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that, you know, as fans, we just got to hang in there, guys, if you're listening, and hang in there. It will come. We will get it back. And then we've got to make sure that we keep it going and keep going every week and making sure it happens.
And good luck in the tournament.
Yeah, thanks very much. Yeah, no, it's nice being the show pony, having a chat with somebody. I've got to actually go and do the business now. So, yeah, I've talked the talk. I've got to walk the walk now.
I'm sure you'll do it.
Yeah, thank you very much.
My thanks to Scott Mitchell for joining me on this episode of Humans of Speedway. And of course, to you too, for listening. Now, if you're a new listener, then do check out some of our previous episodes, including chats with another Poole and Bradford legend, Gary Havelock, another voice familiar to darts and speedway fans alike, commentator and presenter Nigel Pearson, seven-time British champion Scott Nichols, and FIM Speedway GP race director Phil Morris, among the previous guests, who also each choose their own dream teams and dream meetings too, so find out what their choices are on that. Of course, for the latest updates and preview clips, follow Humans of Speedway on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. And if you've enjoyed it and you've made it this far, then why not leave us a review and give us a rating on your podcast app of choice too. In the meantime, stay safe and join us for the next episode soon. Bye for now.